Hello, this is Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology understandable, interesting, and hopefully enlightening for you and your family. And today we are going to be talking about intimate partner violence. I know it's a heavy subject, but it's one of those things I think as a society we need to discuss so that hopefully we can start abolishing it. It is a horrible crime, and especially if you or someone you know is undergoing abuse at the current time. It's really, really tough. And for the listeners that have been following me, I work at a domestic violence shelter, so I see cases of this on a regular basis, and it is heartbreaking, and it is preventable. So this is why we're here to talk about this really important subject tonight. My special guest is Dr. Clive Kennedy again, and I'm really happy to have him back on. He was a guest of mine in October, and we were also talking about domestic violence back then. And Kavita Deo, and she has been doing some research on this really important subject. So, good evening. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm so happy to be here.
I am happy to have you here. Dr. Kennedy, would you like to tell the audience a little bit about your background, please?
Yes, I'm a professor at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology here in Los Angeles campus, in which I am in the clinical forensic department, and I teach a variety of courses, including intimate partner violence. But mostly assessment, because I am on the court panel. I've been on that since 1985 on the Superior Court panel. And so I do evaluations of individuals who are arrested for domestic violence, as well as other things. We do custody evaluations for individuals who have had that kind of history. And so I'm just happy to be here, and I'm happy to be here with Dr. Deo.
Thank you. And Dr. Deo, hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. And can you tell the audience a little bit about your background also?
I'm currently a doctoral candidate in the clinical forensic department at the Chicago School that Dr. Kennedy teaches at. I'm currently in my psychology internship. And I'll be graduating at the end of this year.
Congratulations. That's a long road, isn't it?
Yes.
So my first question for both of you is, what led you to study intimate partner violence in depth?
I personally, my specialty in the field is focusing on trauma. And intimate partner violence is one of those areas where there's a severe trauma, usually with either children and or adults. So that's what led me to this topic.
You know, I was interested in substance abuse. I was a substance abuse specialist before I became a professor. That was only within the last 10 years. But before, I worked at UCLA as a substance abuse specialist for 22 years. And in that role, I found that a major correlation between substance abuse and domestic violence issues, sexual assault issues. And so that's really kind of how I got involved in intimate partner violence, really as a kind of a backdoor through my first love, which is assessing and treating substance abuse cases.
Right, and they do go hand in hand, definitely. A lot of the women that I have counseled over at the shelter had mentioned that prior to them getting abused, their boyfriends or significant others were using right beforehand, especially like meth. That seems to be a really common drug for the abuser to just let loose. So it's a huge problem. So can both of you define what intimate partner violence really is?
So there's several. Thank you, Dr. Kennedy. So there is physical abuse, which can include physical aggression, such as acts of slapping, hitting, biting, kicking, beating, stabbing, and even shooting. There's also psychological abuse, which is intimidation and belittling. There is forced sexual activity or intercourse, and then controlling behaviors as well, with isolation from family and friends and restricting your partner's access to outside information or assistance. That also includes verbal abuse.
And Dr. Kennedy, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that, the one surprise that I only recently, within the last few years, have recognized, and that is that a person can be in a domestic violence relationship and never have been hit or pushed or shoved or, oftentimes there's a lot of threatening behavior, but power and control is really the predominant features of a DV relationship. And when I used to, think that in order to be in a domestic violence relationship, somebody has to be hit. There has to be violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think overall, I would just want to emphasize to your listeners that that is not the case. There are cases of individuals who have not had a lot of violence in their relationship, but there's a lot of the intimidation and control dynamics that are the hallmark of the DV relationship.
And do you think because of the general public having a common mythology about, well, it's not abuse because he or she did not hit me or kick me or, like you said, have any kind of physical abuse, do you think therefore, they don't think that it's really abuse. It's not registering as abuse.
Yeah, I think you probably know yourself, Julianne, that there are times that when you first mention to your client that they're involved in a DV relationship, there's this disbelief. They never thought of themselves as being abused, So I agree. I think that there are times that, if there isn't, just because they haven't been sent to the hospital or had some major traumatic experience, that they don't pay attention to the fact that they have to beg in order to, buy something for themselves, or they have to beg in order to go visit their family or relatives. They're just not aware that the control issues are more important, if not as important, as the violence.
Right, definitely. It seems to be a disconnect there that they think maybe that's just normal behavior. Correct.
Yes.
Especially if they, if they got into the relationship, there's that power difference between the two. And this could be heterosexual or homosexual relationships, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about what the difference would be of abuse within a heterosexual versus a homosexual relationship? Is there any difference?
I think with same-sex couples, the struggle also includes the sexuality component of the prejudice and stigmas that society places with same-sex couples and not being able to have the legal resources available as a heterosexual couple may have. So I think it's more impacted for same-sex couples altogether.
So they have more resources that they can rely on if it's a heterosexual relationship, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes. I've been on the hotline a few times over at the shelter, and I have had men call up and say, what can I do? My male partner is abusing me. And there aren't a lot of resources. There may be one shelter within LA County that accepts men. It's really a problem.
I agree.
So now there is probably also a mythology that men can't be abused. And like you said, how do you work with somebody that is in a homosexual relationship and has been abused? What would be the difference?
So going back to what I said previously, I think addressing sexuality, I think a big component in same-sex relationships with intimate partner violence is understanding the sexuality component and understanding that they lack even family support because of their sexuality. And they may not have the friends to support them. So a big component would be the social aspect. Another component, like I said, is the sexuality and understanding their struggle in being accepted in society, whether it's their job or their community, their own families, their own friends, and having to deal with those issues as well also come into play when working with individuals, same-sex couples. With intimate partner violence, excuse me.
So during your research, Dr. Dale, do you see these numbers going up or what's happening with it statistic-wise?
Statistically, it's still underreported, if not underreported even more when compared to heterosexual couples that are experiencing intimate partner violence. I know with my own research, I even struggled to obtain participants with the fear of even talking about being in a domestic violence relationship.
So how did you approach that difficulty of finding research candidates for that?
I tried different outlets. I tried domestic violence shelters. I tried using the internet, using family and friends that may have known of communities that could assist. I tried something similar to the Gay and Lesbian Center in Orange County. Like, I tried several outlets and still struggled to obtain participants.
And were the agencies and shelters cooperative with helping you with the research?
Absolutely.
That's great. That's good. And I know there's, because of the funding in the state of California, the number of shelters have decreased over the years, which is another huge problem. I know when I went in last night to work at the shelter, there were 6 women and 11 children. So there were 17 staying in the house and just myself. So that was just, we're so impacted right now. And the problem with a lot of the emergency shelters are they are full. I mean, there's only a handful of them in LA County. And then, you know, going on for transitional sheltering on top of it, that's even less of those houses there. So, you know, what does one do? I mean, what have you found in your research that really surprised you?
Currently in LA County, when I was doing my research, there were a total, I believe, of 7 or 8 domestic violence shelters that supported the LGBT community. And that was quite shocking to see, given how liberal a lot of places can be. And I think the other major thing that stood out was services that are available to men overall. Because I know in some of my research there was, between Canada, United Kingdom, and United States, a total of 6 services or hotlines for men who are victims of intimate partner violence. And that's in 3 major countries.
Oh, that's, wow, that's incredibly sad. Unbelievable.
Right.
Yeah. So,
you know, I wanted to chime in here about the sexuality component. For me, in working with my couples who are gay or lesbian or transgendered, sometimes the relationship is not as well defined in terms of sex roles as some of the heterosexual couples that I've dealt with. And so the couple they're trying to kind of find their way in terms of roles, child care and household chores and things that are a little bit easier for individuals who have traditional ways in which they embrace traditional sex roles. Whereas, you know, with a gay couple, sometimes they really do have to kind of communicate openly about their preferences and appropriate times for being sexual and what have you. That becomes a place in which there are likely conflicts. And it's how they navigate these conflicts that sometimes get them in trouble. And, of course, if they've been exposed to relationships as children in which there was open arguing and where one person's needs are not attended to as much as the other person's needs, then they really expect some different level of control and power dynamics anyway. So there's really ample opportunity for things to go wrong in a gay and lesbian relationship, and they feel often that there's just not any other resources, that they have to say this is their world. So so they are reluctant to report, and sometimes they feel very alone and feel as though there's nowhere for them to turn. So so I think there are very major differences, I think, in terms of the likelihood of being even aware that you're in a DV relationship, and secondly, for you to communicate and resolve it, and thirdly, for you to seek help. Because there's not a lot of places for you to go to, and especially if you're male, you know, you're talking about the few numbers of hotlines, which is major. But you know, if you live in LA County, and we have a very healthy gay and lesbian population here in Southern California, as compared to some more oppressive jurisdictions. But even here in Los Angeles, a lot of times there's just not a lot of places for a gay male, for example, who's feeling traumatized or victimized in a relationship to go. And, you know, I just think you can't overemphasize that.
So what would one of the things be that you would recommend that if a gay male is in an abusive relationship, what would you recommend that he do first thing?
Well, I think you need to talk. First of all, you need to make sure you don't allow yourself to become isolated within the relationship, where the only place that you can turn is the perpetrator. You know, always maintain your relationships with family members or close friends. Don't allow yourself to get in a situation where the only place you can turn is the person who is controlling you or hurting you. So I think that would be one important step. But if you find yourself in that position, you do need to seek out a hotline where you can talk about it anonymously, privately. But then seek the services of a therapist, because there are some therapists, especially those that are referred by the Gay and Lesbian Services Center here in Los Angeles. We have a couple of very good resources for mental health services in Los Angeles, and Kavita can also talk about that as well.
Dr. Dale, can you make a comment on that also?
I agree with what Dr. Kennedy is saying. Another issue that comes up with the gay and lesbian population in intimate partner violence situations is internalized homophobia. And I think being able to talk about some of that in therapy is a great place to start, because it does cause for lower self-esteem and self-worth.
Yeah, that
can increase the chances of ending up as a victim in intimate partner violence situations.
Right, and then in a situation with a therapist, if they don't understand how to treat that population, then it's like, you know, then the person can feel victimized again within the therapy room. So, you know, it's one of those situations where doing the research and finding the proper therapist to work with.
Yeah, and there are actually, in some of the shelters, LGBT-specific shelters and then LGBT-sensitive. So in the specific, staff is trained to assist individuals and families within the LGBT community. And then with the sensitive, they are more aware, and they're not necessarily trained as a specific, but they do have staff that are specifically trained for the LGBT community in certain locations.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, within the LGBT community, and what are the barriers besides the ones that we've talked about before about reporting? I mean, within any abusive relationship, you're going to have the guilt and the shame and, you know, those kind of heavy components that are stopping a person from going and getting assistance. Is there anything else specifically within the LGBT community that would be a barrier?
For men in the LGBT community, I think it's looking at hypermasculinity as one of the issues and trying to fit into a society where everyone should be heterosexual. I think that's one of the major issues for gay men in their own relationships. And that, again, leads to the internalized homophobia. And then it's very similar to intimate partner violence with heterosexual couples with the mental health issues and substance abuse. And there's also intergenerational abuse that occurs with homosexual population as well. It's not just with heterosexuals.
Right. There's definitely a multi-generational transmission of abuse, too. And like you had brought up before, you know, depending on what kind of households they've grown up in and, you know, what, you know, whether it was between their parents or, you know, parents and boyfriends, girlfriends or whatever family dynamics they grew up in. A lot of times that's what they end up internalizing, and it looks normal to a child because they don't know any better. And they just, you know, assimilate that in their brain, and then they carry that on unless there's some kind of break within that transmission, correct?
Correct.
So can
I'll just going to add that, you know, a lot of times by the time you become a couple in the LGBT community, you have had a certain level of conflict in your own family, and sometimes you've developed this close bond with this one other person, and you may have even burned some bridges in your traditional family, and so it makes it difficult for you now to go and seek help with this family that has ostracized you in the past, perhaps, or ridiculed you. And I mean, I've had situations with couples that I'm working with where, you know, the one of the family members has said, you know, that now she wants to come back here and she needs help now, and, you know, and really ridiculing the person who is already, you know, feeling humiliated and devastated by being abused in her sexual relationship. So sometimes it that adds to the feeling of isolation and the lack of resources that a person might have.
And Julian, can I add one more thing to that?
Yes.
And I think it's also the overall response to their victimization. So if they do call law enforcement and it's a same-sex couple of men, then the idea of, oh, you're just two guys beating on each other is the mentality or how could you, you know, how could you possibly be harmed if you're two guys hitting each other? Whereas if it was a heterosexual couple, it would be the woman is in danger and we need to protect the woman.
Right. And I think, too, and this doesn't hold true for all law enforcement, but from some of the stories that I've heard in the shelter, there's kind of that good old boy mentality of some of the officers and going to, you know, a DV call and, you know, with a gay couple. I'm sure that they're going to, in a way, treat that differently than if it was like a heterosexual couple. Just the way they approach it and the attitude that they bring with them to the door, I would imagine would be different.
Right.
Yeah. And it you know, again, it's sensitivity training, correct?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which there needs to be a lot more of, but it's slow coming. So we are going to take a commercial break. We are going to come back with Dr. Clive Kennedy and Dr. Kavita Deo. Thank you very much for listening to Psych 101.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School for sponsoring Psych 101. And we are back with Dr. Clive Kennedy and Dr. Kavita Deo. So, now, within your research, how long did your research go on for your dissertation?
It was over a span of 3 years that I completed my dissertation.
And what did you base it around? The specific question that you really want to answer, or the issue.
I just want to clarify really quick. I'm not a doctor yet. I'm just a doctoral candidate. So.
Okay. Well, Dr. Kennedy was calling you doctor. I'm sorry.
No worries.
Sounds good, right?
You know, I'm so sorry. I forgot which class you were in.
Don't worry.
I must apologize for that. I thought you were in the class above, but that's okay.
No worries.
Yeah, but okay. It sounds good, right? So, anyways, Kavita, so within your research, what was the main topic that you were working on? What was, you know, the overall issues?
Kavita?
Hi, Kavita, are you still there?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, good.
We had a disconnect there. Yes.
Oh, I apologize.
That's okay.
So I'll just start over. My research altogether was looking at the likelihood of reporting intimate partner violence between same-sex couples and heterosexual couples. And I broke it down a little bit further, and I separated it into heterosexual men, homosexual men, homosexual females, and heterosexual females. And was trying to see if there was a difference between the four groups, if reporting was higher or lower across the board.
And the heterosexual women, I would imagine, what had the highest rates, correct?
I actually was not able to gather a large enough sample with the homosexual population to have clear statistics as to whether or not there was a major difference. But across gender in general, I did find that underreporting was still a major issue, and that supports the research that's already out there that there is underreporting, and some of that can be linked to simply the definition of intimate partner violence and what is considered to be domestic violence.
Right. Again, there needs to be public education surrounding that, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. It was really interesting. I mean, there for a while, it seemed like there was a lot more billboards and public service announcements and such that were out for reporting and you know, at least putting in the minds of the general public, okay, well, if you're going through this, this isn't normal and you need to go get help. It seems like there's a pullback again from that kind of PSA, which, you know, I wish that would not be the case, because there does need to be more, you know, education going on about it, saying, you know, if you're going through this, this isn't normal and you need to go get help. So have you seen any kind of signs whatsoever that that's improving?
No, I think there's a lack of knowledge in general with the lesser forms of domestic violence or intimate partner violence, and understanding that verbal abuse and psychological abuse and coercion can all be forms of intimate partner violence. I think if the advertisement that's going to be put out there focuses on the lesser form, maybe more people would come forward with their victimization or understanding better. And I think the issue is that there is an inconsistency across the board with the definition of what is intimate partner violence.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to have you repeat that last sentence, because your signal's cutting out a little bit, and I think it's really important information.
I'm not sure what my last sentence was, but overall, I think there is an inconsistency with the definition of intimate partner violence, and people are not informed of the lesser forms of intimate partner violence, so the what emotional abuse may look like, or verbal abuse and psychological and coercion, those types, I think, need to be advertised a little bit more versus just the physical abuse that most people associate with intimate partner violence to begin with.
Yes. Kavita, I'm sorry. You know, are you calling from a cell phone?
I am.
Is there any way that you can call us back from a landline?
Not from a landline.
Okay, is there any way that you can move to a different location? You're cutting out a little bit, and I would really love to keep having you on. So if you could do that, that would be great. I'm going to talk to Dr. Kennedy about it also while you're kind of changing locations, okay?
Okay.
All right, awesome. Thank you. Dr. Kennedy, would you?
I wanted to add you know, basically, if you're consistently feeling hurt and empowered and humiliated in your relationship, that is not normal. That is not something you have to accept. And so I think it just really means that you have to pay attention to that. And sometimes if you have come from a family where you have tolerated a certain amount of humiliation and ridicule, maybe even at the hands of your siblings, that may have set you up to accept the unacceptable. So again, it is, Kavita was saying, just because you're not having, you know, a black eye or broken bones that we traditionally see in DV relationships, does not mean that you are not experiencing that yourself. If you are constantly or frequently humiliated, belittled, called names in your relationship, that is not something you need to accept. You need to step up and actually defend yourself. And if it doesn't seem to be changing, you may have to leave. And there are times when you may have to leave before you even have someplace else to go, and that's what a shelter is for. And we do have a number of shelters in L.A. County. And I think if you have a hotline, that you have a place where you can talk about some of these issues, they know a lot of the shelters for you that would have be a place that you could that would offer you some retreat.
Yes, and the emergency shelters are can shelter a person for 30 to 45 days in general. And then they work with also the social services aspect of it, getting housing, taking care of any legal issues. They take care of a multitude of problems while one is in the shelter and can take a break and can be safe and, you know, possibly save their own lives. Because it does get to the point where it can be lethal, and that's, you know, that's an incredible problem, and we've seen that happening more and more. We hear about these stories in the news on a weekly basis, it seems like, nowadays. So this is a, you know, very serious issue. Dr. Kennedy, I'm going to have you move a little bit, too, and then Kavita, I'm going to have you. Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, and we're getting a little bit of... Okay. We're testing both of you here right now. It's okay. So I know with the shelter that I work with, we really try to help on a multitude of levels, but it's only like 30 days. But again, it's giving the person a break at least to be able to, you know, get their thoughts and their emotions together and, you know, make a decision and hopefully not go back to the abuser. That's one of the key problems, because a lot of times when there is fuel within that relationship, there is the power situation, of course, and then whoever's being victimized leaves and the abuser comes back and says, okay, I really love you, I'm really sorry. And it seems to be a really common pattern within a lot of abusers that they do this kind of game playing, but it's like almost playing cat and mouse. Kavita, can you make a comment on that?
I agree with you with the cat and mouse game. And in my research, I actually was able to interview my participants, and I asked questions about why they reported and their experience and their difficulty in reporting and things like that. And actually, one of the main reasons that they struggled to leave their victimizer was because of love. And that's, I think, something that working through therapy and understanding your self-worth and self-esteem and that you don't deserve, and understanding even attachment issues and abandonment issues with the victim, I think can go a long way. There's also, a number of issues with even immigration and having children also impacts, like, their decision to whether or not they should leave their victimizer or not.
Yes, children definitely complicate the picture, especially if there's multiple children within the family. That seems to fuel the abuse even more, it seems.
Well, and it becomes more complicated, as you say. Fortunately, there are some shelters in town that have transitional living programs, which after the 30-day period can actually work with the family, even when children are present, or especially when children are present. There are funding sources that are available when children are present. Even if you are currently at a shelter and you're approaching 30 days and you're afraid of returning to the abuser, they can transfer you to a shelter that has a transitional living program. So, again, I can't overemphasize the importance of standing your ground and deciding you're not going to tolerate being abused and mistreated.
And I know for a lot of victims, that takes so much willpower and so much strength to be able to do that, because they're scared, and especially if they're being threatened with their lives, just to be able to stand up to their abuser and just to be able to walk out or run or whatever. And yeah, it's just... how does a person get to that point where they finally stand up? What would you recommend?
I think,
well, again, you know, girlfriend, I mean, not just girlfriends, but friends and family, having anyone in your surroundings who can be a sounding board and who you can, you know, kind of get your thoughts together, I think is a key part of it.
And recognizing
that you don't feel good, and recognizing that you don't want to go home after work, recognizing that this is a person that doesn't, you know, cherish your strengths, recognizing your unique qualities that you bring to the relationship, recognizing that, you know, that you're losing sleep, or you're using more substances than you used to, or just recognizing that things are not well in your relationship and in your life.
Right, that's a great recommendation. I hate to tell you both that we're having technical problems here, so I'm going to have one of you continue with the conversation, and if the other one can, did either one of you have access to a landline?
I do have
a landline, and I can call and transfer over.
Okay, Dr. Kennedy, I'm going to have you call back then, and then I'm going to have Kavita just keep on talking, okay? I really appreciate it. Okay, Kavita, do you have anything to add to that?
I think a lot of times when I interviewed my participants, a lot of the things that came up was that they actually did not report that it was actually a neighbor or a friend or family member that ended up calling the police, and that was the intervention that took place. I think there's some resistance to that, too, because they might not feel like they belong in the shelter, or that it's going to increase the level of danger for them and their children. So, again, I think it goes back to the knowledge of what is intimate partner violence and understanding what services are available, because that was another issue, was not knowing where to go and who to seek help from, and understanding legal status and, you know, the possibility of losing your children because of all of this. I think it's definitely a lot to consider when, you know, you're trying to decide to report. And without that knowledge, I think people get caught up in the system and they just rather stay where they're at.
Yeah, stay out of fear, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
I think staying out of fear, oh, I'm back, by the way. Hello?
Hi, Dr. Kennedy?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. You know what? We're still having technical problems, so I'm going to have either one of you stay on the line with me and finish up the show. So whichever one wants to stay on, just let me know.
Okay. Are you up to it, or what would you like me to do?
I can't hear Dr. Kennedy.
I'm sorry?
I can't hear you.
Oh, okay. Why don't I stay on, I think I can feel, can you hear me well, or?
Yeah, actually, you know what? I'm sorry this is happening. This is, you know, because we've got two lines going and you're both on cell phones. I think that's what the problem has been here. So I'm going to have, Kavita, would you like to continue with me, or would Dr. Kennedy like to continue? Okay, so sorry, listeners, that we're having this issue here. This is the first time that I've tried this on the show. So this is really interesting. I agree with Kavita and Dr. Kennedy that just being able to get your inner strength up and be able to know your self-worth. Don't let somebody else tell you what you're worth or not worth, because, you know, you're precious. You are a precious person, and you need to go and just, you know, get up the inner strength and leave, go to a friend's place, go to a family's place, hopefully where the abuser does not know where that other person lives, because then there's a problem of stalking and following. So, Kavita, are you back with me?
I am.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay. Yeah, okay. So, where did we leave off?
About talking about finding ways to lead your perpetrator. And I discussed that a lot of times it was someone else that made the call for the victim, whether it's a family member or church member, neighbors. A lot of times they are living in so much fear that it's easier for someone else to be supporting.
So in that case, I know, like last night I had a mother call for a daughter because the daughter was just, you know, she was so frightened that she couldn't call. Is that really, do you find that's really typical?
With my research with the participants reporting on their experience, that was a lot of the response was that someone else had been reporting for them.
Okay. Okay. Kavita?
Yes.
Hi. Can I have you move again? Because you're breaking up again.
Can you hear me better?
Oh, okay. Just talk a little bit and see if we can make a reconnection with your cell phone here, okay?
Okay.
Okay, so... Okay, I'm sorry that we're having so many problems with this here. Actually, you know what? What I'm going to do is, would you be willing to come back within a few weeks, you and Dr. Kennedy, and do a landline interview?
Absolutely.
That would be great, because I feel that I'm not doing you justice with this interview. You're breaking in and out, and this is really important information here. So... What are your plans now for future research?
With the research, I think, you know, really looking into the limitations of this particular population, and right now there are minimal services, if any, that look at a triad within intimate partner violence, and that's looking at mental health and substance abuse co-occurring with intimate partner violence. And there aren't services that offer these three, because a lot of times agencies don't know how to incorporate these three for treatment. So that's definitely one way to go with it. And another way is to looking at law enforcement and teaching sensitivity to first responders of domestic violence.
So within your... You know, within your research and intuition, how far ahead do you think that it's going to be before we're able to incorporate these services?
I think it'll be some time. I think it's still a newer population of research that's coming out, and we're just realizing with the research now that heterosexual men can be victims of intimate partner violence, and I think the struggle is going to be removing society's stances and their views of what gender roles should be and should not be. And then there's also influences of culture and religion barriers as well.
Yeah, there's so much to work on, isn't there?
There's a lot.
Right. And it's also, I think, teaching all these components within grad school, because they are so new. It's, you know, there's so much education that needs to happen within this realm alone. And I know I took one DV class, and it was just the tip of the iceberg. It just, you know, it did not even address the LGBT community. It was just for heterosexual couples, and that was it. And it was just like I said, it just hit the the tip of the iceberg. It just wasn't enough information, but it was only one semester. So, you know, what do you do? I just keep on getting educated as a clinician and as a general public too. And realize that this can be changed. This can be prevented. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it just scratches the surface because there's so many subcultures within this issue alone that need to be addressed.
Yes, that is, that's true. Okay, Kavita, I am going to let you go early here. I'm sorry, I would love to have both you and Dr. Kennedy on again. Let's discuss this further, okay?
Thank you so much, Julianne.
Thank you, Kavita. Thank you. Thank you, you too. That was Kavita Deo and Dr. Clive Kennedy, and I'm so sorry that we are having technical issues. It happens sometimes when we have cell phone callers in. So anyways, I would like to reach out to the audience. If you would like to contact me, my email address is jgoode8@verizon.net. And my phone number is 562-234-4650. Contact me. I would love to hear your opinions and any help that I can offer you, or, you know, contacts or whatever. I'd be happy to do so. And in the realms of domestic violence, if you or anybody that you know about is having problems, the number to call is 211, and that is within California. That is the statewide hotline for any kind of DV services. Great service. You can call anytime, anywhere, and please do so. Domestic violence can be a really serious matter, and it needs to be stopped. It needs to be resolved, and It can be prevented. That's all I can say. It's just, go get help on that. So thank you so much for listening. This has been Julianne Good for Psych 1-on-1. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Bye now.